You are listening to KMUZ Turner. We're the community radio station for the Mid-Willamette Valley, broadcasting to Marion, Polk, and Linn counties at 88.5 FM and serving Salem and Kaiser at 100.7 FM. Also streaming online at kmuz.org and on your smartphone or tablet through the free TuneIn Radio app. This is Deanne Bass, and I'm your host of Teacher Talk, and today I have a wonderful show. I have Barbara Steinberg. Welcome to the show, Barbara.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Well, I took a couple of your classes this year, 3, 101, 202, and 303, all on dyslexia. So tell us your story. I know you were a teacher before you had your own company, PDX Reading Specialist. How did you get started being a teacher?
Well, I always say that I was born to teach, and I never thought I would do anything else. Mm-hmm. And quite honestly, I never thought that I would leave the classroom. Mm-hmm. I started teaching fourth and fifth grade, and my love was literacy, so I eventually moved into middle school and taught language arts. And for the 12 years that I was a classroom teacher, the kids that I would lie awake thinking about night after night mm-hmm. were the ones who were very smart, who worked their tails off, and who had incredible oral language skills. So when we would discuss a really complicated text or read a novel, they had insights and questions and mm-hmm. connections that were unlike other students. And yet, when I would ask them to write about our learning, mm-hmm. I saw this huge disconnect. And I was really, you know, dumbfounded. How could these brilliant, you know, speakers and who had such rich vocabulary not be able to communicate that in writing, and their spelling right. was terrible. Mm-hmm. And for years, I kind of, you know, ran circles around myself. And it was one year that a colleague handed me a book called Overcoming Dyslexia. And I read it. And when I came to the end, I was equally frustrated as much as I was. It was my light bulb moment. And I was frustrated because here I had taught for so many years, and mm-hmm. the students who had come through my classroom, their faces just came flashing back to me. Oh. And I had never received this training in my teacher preparation class. I had my master's at that point, and nobody had ever mentioned dyslexia. And yet, after reading this iconic text that clearly pointed to the brain research that supports its existence,
right.
It was so obvious that these kids all shared characteristics of dyslexia, and I didn't have the tools to help them.
And what time frame was that? Was that in the 90s?
Yeah, so this was about 1998. And so the fire was lit in my belly, mm-hmm. and I started to look around for more information. And believe it or not, at that time, there were no classes on dyslexia. Everything was buried in these institutions on the East Coast. And here I am in, you know, Oregon. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have access. There were no online classes. And I found this dean of education at Merrill Hirsch University, Tom Rule, who since has passed. And I told him my story. And he said, I will mentor you through a program of study. And that's what I did. And I really had wow. this unbelievable, talk about individualized education experience
yeah.
Of working with him. Yeah, and really learning not only the foundational skills required to teach reading that all teachers need, mm-hmm. that clearly reading specialists need. I, you know, had a reading specialist endorsement. I didn't have any of these skills. Mm-hmm. But also the foundational knowledge of what language-based reading disabilities are. Mm-hmm. And it was after graduating that I came to this crossroads of, wow, I am a teacher. I am a classroom teacher. I'm a public school teacher. Mm-hmm. But how can I go back into the school system when they are denying the existence of dyslexia, a learning right. disability that right. affects one in five? And I'm a little feisty, and I wasn't willing to be told I couldn't say that word. Mm-hmm. And so I made a really, you know, difficult choice to start my own company. And that was in 2000.
So not that long ago, really.
Not that long
All
ago.
Right. So what is, you know, you're talking about language difficulties, and what is the real definition of dyslexia?
Oh, that's a great question. So dyslexia is a specific learning disability
okay.
that is neurological in origin. And that's one of the very first things that has to be debunked about dyslexia, is that it's not an issue with seeing language. Dyslexics see language and words and letters in the same way that everybody else does. The mm-hmm. problem is with manipulating it. And that's where it's a language processing struggle. So in order to be a proficient reader, mm-hmm. you have to master something called the alphabetic principle. And the alphabetic principle says that words that we hear as whole units of sound mm-hmm. must be broken down to their smallest sounds. And that's the phoneme. And that smallest sound is then, of course, attached to the symbol that represents it. Right. That is one of the foundational deficits of dyslexia.
Okay, breaking it down, being yep. able to identify that there's a sound at the beginning, there's another sound in the middle, there's another sound.
Exactly.
And that there's symbols that represent
That's
those.
Exactly
okay.
right.
Okay. And so your company, PDX Reading Specialist, you provide services for teachers, for yeah, people with dyslexia?
Question.
Or
so when I first started, I decided that I was going to work one-on-one with students, because even though I had all of this theoretical knowledge, it didn't mean anything until I sat across from a student. And not just one student, lots of students, mm-hmm. to see how their brains work. How do they master this complex code in a way that is truly different from 80% of the population? And it was through that experience that, I mean, the connections were made. It was the bridge that I needed to connect university study with working one-on-one with a child, which is still the way that most dyslexia is remediated, is one-on-one. Mm-hmm. And using an Orton-Gillingham-based methodology, which means that it is, you know, simultaneously multisensory and explicit and systematic. And as I, you know, the first couple of years worked with these kids, I became really intrigued by not only how their brains work, but also I came to realize that I was very much in a reactive position, meaning by the time a family called me and needed my services, mm-hmm. they were in a dire state. Their kids had this huge gap. Their self-esteem was in the toilet. Most of them believe that their brains were broken. They are dumb. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, I really want to be in a proactive position. And right. who are the people that are spending the most time with these kids? Teachers like me. Mm-hmm. Teachers who are well-intentioned, who have lots of education, who have spent years in the classroom, and no fault of their own, have absolutely no idea what's going on for this kid. And so, and because a classroom and teachers is my platform, I said, those are the people I really want to get in front of. And mm-hmm. so I started to offer workshops. And the workshops, you know, have slowly grown. Mm-hmm. And they've been fueled by the work of other organizations like Decoding Dyslexia Oregon
right.
and the passage of legislation. And of course, now that we have legislation that's going to be implemented come 2017, there will actually be mandatory training for at least one K-5 educator in each public school in the state of Oregon.
So by 2017, each school is required, mandated, to have a dyslexia expert.
Yeah.
And what would they do? What would be the charge of the dyslexia expert or screener or?
And the title is really ambiguous at best. So the two pieces of legislation, Senate Bill 612 and House Bill 2412, there's three pieces of it.
Okay.
One is that every kindergarten or first grade student, depending on when they enter school, mm-hmm. will be screened. And the screening is going to include a variety of components, looking at family history, looking at phonological awareness, rapid naming. It's going to round out some existing kindergarten screenings that are in place already to look for the warning signs of dyslexia. It's not diagnostic. It's intended to really look at those early warning signs. The second component is that teacher training. And the quantity of training is going to be up to districts. And the districts are really charged with figuring out how they're going to provide this training for this one we'll call them the point person.
Okay.
What the outcome of that training is going to be in terms of, is that person going to be responsible for working with kids? It's an unknown. There's a lot still being worked out at the Oregon Department of Education, and there's a dyslexia committee that's working with Dr. Carrie Thomas Beck, who is our state dyslexia representative.
Okay.
Well, and then, of course, the third component of the legislation is charging TSPC with training pre-service teachers.
Oh, okay.
So those that are in the university system.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the three components of the law, and it's very exciting. And it's something that in 2010, I did not ever think was possible. I felt like I was a lone soldier. And that dyslexia awareness was was a thing of the far distant future.
So you must have been really instrumental in having this legislation come to fruition. Right?
Well, I give all the credit to Decoding Dyslexia Oregon, which is a group, a grassroots movement of parents. You know, parents really have the fire in their belly. Their intentions are completely, there's no dual intentions, if that makes any sense. They're there fighting for the kids. And they just rallied. They were a dynamite group of women, rallied the troops and got everybody involved, professionals, teachers, parents, and in the very first session got this legislation passed, which is remarkable.
That's a lot of work.
It is.
That's impressive. And so what are the numbers again? There's a House bill and a Senate bill.
Correct. So Senate bill 612.
612.
And House bill 2412.
Okay. I'm going to look more at the language. Thanks for giving me all that information. And so step three was to work with TSPC, Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. Okay.
Yes.
Thanks for tuning in. You are listening to Teacher Talk on KMUZ 88.5 FM and 100.7 FM in the Salem area. Today, my guest is Barbara Steinberg. She is a teacher who left the classroom to be a dyslexia specialist, and she has her own company, PDX Reading Specialists, based out of Lake Oswego. Now back to our interview.
So to circle back to your question about what PDX Reading Specialist does, we do a lot. And it's not just me, it's my team. So the very first thing that we do is assessment. Because before you can start to remediate dyslexia, you really need to find out where in the brain there's an impacted area. Is it in phonological awareness? Is it in visual processing? And the metaphor I always give is you would never show up at the doctor if your arm hurt and say, well, just cast it. And that's why jumping in and tutoring is a cart before the horse model. So assessment is a critical component. And from that, you develop an action plan. And that action plan is multi-pronged. It involves remediation. We do need to close this gap that exists in a way that works for this child's brain. But we also need to, at the school level, figure out what accommodations this child needs to be able to perform in school during the day at the point of performance when stakes are high, when their self-esteem is on the line and their peers are there. And when they're in a safe zone, like at home, they can learn the skills that they're lacking. And then, of course, the third component to that, you know, support plan is empowering this child to embrace their learning style and moving away from this mindset of, I just want to be like everybody else. And that's probably the most difficult piece of what I do when working with a kid, because every child, with the exception of a very small percentage, can learn to read when taught in a way that works for their brain. But once their self-esteem has been destroyed, recovering from that is a much more difficult task.
Right. So if you get somebody in the fifth grade who's gone through kindergarten, through fifth, that's literally 6 years of feeling frustrated and like your brain isn't working. So
a lot of shame. Another key thing that PDX Reading Specialist does is advocate. And that goes right along with the inspiration and empowerment. If parents, who I believe are the number one advocates for their child, don't feel like they have the tools or the knowledge to go in and advocate on their child's behalf, whether that's for a formal plan of accommodations, like a 504 plan or an IEP, I often go and accompany parents. Okay. But philosophically, I believe that parents should be the first ones to speak on their child's behalf. And so a lot of my job is giving parents those tools. But I do a fair share of attending school meetings.
Yeah. And then back to the assessments. What kind of tools do you use for the assessments?
Because written language is rooted in oral language, the very first thing that you have to look at is oral language. Mm-hmm. What's this child's receptive and expressive language? From there, you look at the phonological processes that are involved in being able to make that connection from whole words to component pieces.
Okay.
That's phonological awareness, that's phonological memory, and that's also something called rapid naming, which is something that very few educators know about. And what rapid naming is all about is being able to automatically and instantaneously retrieve a name code for a visual symbol. So for example, a letter is a visual symbol, mm-hmm. and that visual symbol represents a name of a letter and also a sound. And to be able to do that with automaticity mimics the reading process. What we see in second, third, fourth grade as reading fluency starts as being able to name colors, name objects, name numbers. And so that's part of the phonological processes. And that's why we can identify the red flags for dyslexia mm-hmm. as early as kindergarten. Okay. It's also about functional assessment. What is this child's sound symbol awareness? Can they read a list of nonsense words? Why nonsense words? Because nonsense words remove all of the compensation strategies that kids can use when they're reading. We can't rely on vocabulary. We can't rely on context or syntax. We have to rely on what we know about the sound symbol relationship. Oral reading fluency, writing, fine motor skills. It's comprehensive.
If a parent is interested in having you do an assessment, you would do it in their home or they bring the child to a facility you have? Or
yeah, our offices are located in Lake Oswego.
Okay.
And we have parents come from all over the state to do an assessment. And after assessment, then obviously we try to provide services in a location that is convenient. Mm-hmm. And so as dyslexia awareness grows, and actually Decoding Dyslexia now has a Salem chapter, it is brand new. I imagine that our services will extend down to the Salem area, but I do have quite a few families who have come up to Lake Oswego for assessment and consultation to help them navigate the school system.
Nice. So you provide assessment,
mm-hmm.
you provide tutoring,
mm-hmm.
and you provide
advocacy.
Support. Advocacy, thank
uh-huh.
you. And
professional development.
And professional development, yeah, that's I think that's where I heard of you first, was I took some classes from you during the summer, and they were really informative. And I've been teaching forever. I'm really old. How long have I been teaching? Maybe 20 years?
Uh-huh.
Long time. And I'm a special education teacher.
Yes.
And you provided information that was really helpful to me. And I know you're doing more workshops. I mean, are those ongoing? Are they only in the summer or are they throughout the...
Well, time is our greatest enemy, right?
Yeah, right.
And teachers work harder than any professionals, in my humble opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And so finding time that teachers have to be able to devote to their own professional development is one of the greatest challenges.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, our state doesn't have, except for this tomorrow,
yes.
where I'm actually doing a workshop in Salem.
Thank you for listening to Teacher Talk. This show is pre-recorded. So the tomorrow we were talking about was October 14th. There was a teacher in-service day on October 14th that Barbara Steinberg came down to provide professional development for teachers. Now back to our interview.
There aren't mutually exclusive days for professional development. So the majority is in the summer. But okay. I do offer workshops throughout the year, and my schedule is available online. Okay. And I'm also in the process of working with a videographer, and I have somebody developing my site where they're going to be online as well. Because unless you live within driving distance, mm-hmm. there isn't an option. And so they're not as great as in person, but they are very well done and engaging, and they have, you know, clickable activities. So it will be a great extension to the in-person workshops I offer.
So you're listening to Teacher Talk on KMUZ at 88.5 FM around the Valley and at 100.7 in the Salem-Keizer area. I'm your host, Deanne Bass, and today I have Barbara Steinberg, and she is the owner of PDX Reading Specialist, and she has a wealth of information on dyslexia. And October is the Dyslexia Awareness Month. So how long have we had a Dyslexia Awareness Month? Since 2010 also? Or?
No, I actually think that a declaration was signed last year that recognized October as Dyslexia Awareness Month. I could be mistaken. It could have been the year before, but it is very new.
It's very new.
Yep.
Okay. And you were mentioning some facts. You said 1 in 5.
Yeah, the prevalence of dyslexia is something that you can't definitively nail down. And the reason for that is the only people who really are counted when figuring out the prevalence are those who are identified in special education. And what we know is that 80% of those who are identified as specific learning disability for special education are in fact dyslexic. And so when you take into consideration all of those students, and you know how many students will never qualify, they put the prevalence at 1 in 5.
Okay.
But it's quite a large range. So the current statistic, though, is 1 in 5.
That sounds really high. I mean, that sounds really prevalent. And you think of all the people who don't even get assessed for special education because either they move a lot or parents aren't interested or don't understand it or are just somehow missed.
And that's one of the biggest challenges I face being in private practice, because I recognize that only those who have the funds can access my services. Mm-hmm. And when you're a public school educator, you believe in equality. Mm-hmm. You believe every child deserves the same services. And that's why dyslexia is so very much an equity issue. When I went into private practice, I said, when I am no longer told that I can't say the word dyslexia, I'll reemerge, right? And people, you know, asked me when dyslexia legislation was passed, aren't you scared you're going to go out of business? And I thought, you know what? If I go out of business, I will be so happy to know that dyslexia is something that every single educator and parent and knows about and talks about, and I'm sure I will find something else to do.
I'm
not too worried.
You're not worried about it. I can see that. I bet the tests that we do in schools are different than the tests that you give in your organization, because, you know, we do the IQ assessment and we do like a nationally normed academic assessment. And
absolutely.
That's what we look at. So yours is a lot more specific.
It's a lot more specific, and you have to think of the goal, right? The goal of a school assessment isn't diagnostic. It's intended to determine eligibility. And so while we could administer the exact same assessment, it's what are these results going to do, right? Mm-hmm. Data is meaningless if you can't transition it into an action plan. Mm-hmm. And that action plan isn't necessarily just what services does this child need, but it's also what are their strengths and how do we play to those strengths? So I think it's just the approach that might vary a little bit. And like you said, not every child is a candidate for a school eligibility evaluation.
Right. The people that you assess, are they all children or do you assess adults as well?
I don't do adult assessment. I would say that the majority of individuals that I see for assessment are first through third grade.
Okay.
And there's actually been quite a shift. It used to be more third through fifth grade. But again, with growing awareness, I'm now getting calls from parents. And their first question is, you know, is it too early? And the thing is about dyslexia and evaluating for dyslexia, you can't actually have dyslexia if you haven't received instruction. You have to have received instruction. And so if you get a end of kindergartner, first grader who's really struggling, that raises the question of, well, how can we do a dyslexia assessment? And I circle back to that discussion about screening, finding those red flags and intervening, because we don't have to necessarily at the end of kindergartner put a label on it. But if we can already see that this child is having retrieval challenges or phonologically they're weak, let's provide intervention, because we know that with that targeted intervention, we're going to close that gap, and then they can go on and put on those building blocks of the reading house successfully. But if we wait, right? A lot of damage is done in so many ways.
It seems like boys and girls develop at such a different rate. Is there more boys that you assess? If you did a boy-girl ratio, what do you see?
Oh, such an interesting question. So when I talk to a parent, right, I use a metaphor of an iceberg, because what a parent is doing is reporting all of the things that are the tip of the iceberg, what's above the surface. Mm-hmm. And so often, those symptoms, those tip of the iceberg things that parents report to me, are academically based and they're behaviorally based. And when a child doesn't feel like they're performing in a school setting, what often sets in is stress. In stress, we have a neurobiological response to stress, which is fight or flight, right? We've often heard that fight or flight mode. Well, when we have fight or flight, the behaviors that are exhibited from that show themselves as avoidance, acting out. So you start to see these behaviors that then get reported to parents. You know, I'm really concerned because Johnny is really distracted. Now, wait a minute. Is he really distracted, or is that avoidance? And is it avoidance of a task that is really, really difficult? And so the number of boys that are identified in special education is disproportionate to the number of girls for that reason. But the number of children who have dyslexia, it's 50-50.
Oh, that's interesting.
Very.
And it seems like now that there's a lot of students that have been identified as having ADD or ADHD.
That's right.
And sometimes parents choose to use medication and sometimes they don't. Would the medication change your brain neurologically to make the, is it phonemic awareness easier for them?
So there's a very high comorbidity between dyslexia and ADHD.
Okay.
It's actually about 40%. So 40% of those who have dyslexia also have ADHD. And so when you think about if you truly have ADHD and sustaining attention is something that's difficult for you, you could imagine that that would be a reason that you have weak academic skills. So the question is always, are your weak academic skills the result of ADHD or because of it? And then it becomes really a little bit of a science experiment. Okay, if we see a child and we see characteristics of ADHD, we see characteristics of dyslexia, and obviously we want to refer and say, you know, you really should consider further evaluation for the ADHD, but we want to give this child some targeted intervention to see if the reason that their skills are so low is because they didn't actually get the instruction in a way that was meaningful for them. Now, untreated ADHD, if they truly are clinically ADHD, will completely sabotage any kind of academic growth, any type of academic intervention. And so I understand and respect when a child is diagnosed with ADHD, parents have some really difficult choices to make. The different approaches to addressing ADHD, it's not all or none. It's not all pharmaceutical. It's not all, you know, biofeedback. It's not all strategy work. But at some point, you have to look at and make a cost, it's a cost-benefit analysis. How impacted is your child, and how is that directly contributing to whatever other challenges they have? So it's different for every child, as is everything in the field of education.
It's complicated.
It's very complicated.
PDX Reading Specialist has been in business for 6 years. And do you have any success stories?
Oh my gosh.
I bet.
Every day I have success stories. I mean, success can be measured in so many different ways. When I left the classroom, I had almost like an identity crisis because those kids were like my kids. And I, you know, in the process of over the years of being a teacher, also had my own children, and I appreciate the differences of relationship between your classroom students and your own biological children. But I cried at the end of every year. These kids were part of my life, and I still walk around, you know, my community and will run into students who are now in their 20s, married, have babies of their own, and they have very much a part of me. And so when I went into private practice, I really feared that I was going to lose that relationship. I feel like relationship is at the root of everything that you do, and relationships are foundations for teachers. Mm-hmm. And so when you only see a child for an assessment or a consult, you wonder, you know, are you making an impact? And I really did wrestle with that when I decided to leave teaching. But I have to tell you, the parents come back and they cry on my shoulder. Oh. The kids write notes. The tutors share stories. And I mean, I will say that because I just have such a soft spot for kids in general, I go out of my way to try to sponsor a kid for a jog-a-thon or write them a note when I hear they did something amazing, because I recognize that their school day, their job, where they spend the majority of their life, they may not be getting a lot of positive feedback. And if I can be that person in their life that is an educator and is giving them positive feedback, then maybe that will help shift their own belief in their abilities as a learner. And that's profound.
How many people do you think have gone through your business so far?
Oh my goodness. Well, our current caseload right now is 100 kids. So we have 100 kids that are getting ongoing intervention.
Nice.
I realize that they cycle in and out, right? Mm-hmm. Our mission is we want to provide, we call it literacy triage, right? Mm-hmm. Get you up to where you need to be or as close to where you need to be. Mm-hmm. And then we can go into more maintenance. So, for example, maintenance is I see a kiddo on Monday. He's a middle schooler. We worked with him for 18 months, and now I'm seeing him for a technology consult. Let's learn how to use your iPad so you can take notes of the board. That wasn't a need when he was in fourth grade.
I see.
So we circle back around.
Okay.
But oh my gosh, over the course of 6 years, probably 400 or 500 families.
Wow. That's amazing. That is so many. That's a lot of lives to change.
It is.
Good work.
Thank you.
And so the services you provide change depending on what the student needs.
Absolutely.
It'll change over time. And is there a theory of, like, if they are going to get tutoring services, is it once a week, once a day, twice a week? And then do you go through the summers? Do you offer tutoring in the summers?
So the research says that you need intervention at least twice a week for 50 minutes to an hour to make substantial gains. And there are lots of different models out there. Some people are able to pull their kids out for part of the day and they provide intervention every day. Because the reality is, the more touches you have, the faster the gains are going to accumulate. Mm-hmm. But the reality is, kids are busy. And I'm talking about kids that are in traditional educational settings. They have their after-school activities.
Right.
And we certainly would never advocate for removing those. They need that outlet. They need that positive feedback. It's part of nourishing their being. And so we see kids twice a week. Now, we have a variety of homeschool kids. And the homeschool model works where either we're supporting parents who are administering intervention for their kids, or we're working on almost a daily basis.
Oh, nice.
So it does depend on the individual student, the severity of their deficit, to determine how long we're going to need to work with them. But I always say there is no scripted guarantee. And anyone who says, we will have your child reading at grade level in X amount of time, you should run far and fast, because you can only go as fast as a child can master a skill. And the key is teaching to mastery. The reading house is built on a foundation, and that foundation has to be strong, and then you start layering on the bricks. And if a brick is shaky, you don't want to keep going, because eventually that house is going to start to wobble and collapse, and a child determines that pace.
You are listening to Teacher Talk on KMUZ, and today my guest is Barbara Steinberg. Barbara, you are a wealth of information. What advice do you have for teachers?
So, if a teacher was to ask me, I know one of my students is dyslexic, and I would venture to guess there's probably more than one student in your class that's dyslexic, what can I do? Because it's really not practical to think that at this point in time, every teacher is going to be able to go back and learn that foundational knowledge that I say transcends curriculum, that knowledge about the rules that govern our language. Until it's really changed at the university level, which is what's happening right now as part of the legislative process, what can a classroom teacher do? And my advice is always, there are some basic accommodations that can really, really change the playing field for your dyslexic kids. And actually, the first one starts with extending the olive branch in terms of acknowledging that you know this child is smart, you know they're working really hard, and you know this task is really hard for them. Because all too often, for a dyslexic learner, it's a vicious cycle. And the vicious cycle is that as soon as they show that they can do something, it's a high five, I knew you could do it, and now here's more of it. And so you end up in this rut of, oh my goodness, I show success and now I have more work. And some basic accommodations are as follows. The first one is the gift of time. So we live in a really fast-paced world, and if you haven't seen it already, I tend to talk really fast. But because dyslexia is a language processing deficit, time is the greatest enemy, and it's also the greatest gift we can give back. And time in terms of, it plays out in many ways. The first is orally. So when we ask a question as simple as, what did you have for breakfast this morning? What did you do this weekend? It requires us to retrieve words from our big giant word bank. And it's not that we don't know the answer. Of course I know what I had for breakfast, and of course I know what I did this weekend, but the time it takes to string those words together and to get them out into a coherent sentence, or even to name the item that I had. You know, if I had cereal, I may not remember or be able to find that word cereal quick enough. It's not automatic. I'm going to talk around it. That thing in a bowl with milk. It's that tip of the tongue. And so to give our kids extra time to retrieve those words, huge benefit. And that's not just for dyslexic kids. It's good for all kids. We call it the wait time. When it comes to reading, it's that extra time. Math, extra time to complete the assignment. And I'm not talking about extra days. Things that are time-bound, like math facts. The minute we put a math fact challenge in front of a kid and it has a time attached to it, anxiety sets in, and research shows that when anxiety is triggered, performance declines. So we really have to ask, what is the goal of this task? And the goal of the task is math fact automaticity, but we're not going to be able to have this child finish 50 problems in, you know, 5 minutes, whatever it may be. Right. So let's remove the time barrier and allow them just to complete the assignment. So extended time is the universal accommodation.
And extended time just in everyday conversations. Not exactly. It doesn't have to be an academic thing.
Exactly. Extended time to process, because language processing is the foundational deficit. The second one is thinking, when we have a task as an educator, to always know what the goal of the task is. What is the learning target? And then asking ourselves as educators, is there another way that this child can perform this task, show their knowledge that works around their primary deficit? And their primary deficit is going to be reading, writing, spelling. And so if it is learning about the Egyptian pyramids and they need to learn everything they can, well, reading about it is just one way to access information. Certainly, those words in a book could also be listened to, and there are multiple, you know, entry points to audiobooks. They could watch a documentary on it. So looking at the variety of approaches to learning content area knowledge. There are tasks that we ask kids to do that are completely arbitrary, like copying from a board. copying from a board is very difficult for a dyslexic learner because they have to capture what's on the board in their working memory and hold on to that long enough to write it down. And because spelling is such a weakness, mm-hmm. they end up having to look up at the board sometimes for every single letter, and they become frustrated. Their writing is really messy. And at the end of the day, what's the educational outcome? There isn't one. We want them just to be able to get in their notebook what's on the board. Could it be given to them? Can they use technology and take a picture of the board? So all of these are really accommodations that may seem inconsequential, but are life-changing for the students that we work with.
Yeah, all those are real doable in a classroom, so that's good to know. And those are certainly things you can try without having the full assessment. You know,
exactly.
It's something that's easily used. Yeah, I have some students that instead of just having them copy from the board, if there's something that I want them to have in their notebook, that's not going to happen for some students. So I use a highlighter, and then they write over it. What do you think of that practice? Should I discontinue
that? Oh, I think
that's
a great strategy.
Because I don't know. It's just like a model, but a little bit more than a model. So
it's scaffolded.
They don't have, yeah.
So exactly.
That's something that kids think is fun. And then I think it's also helpful for their
kids love resume. Highlighters and sticky notes.
give them highlighters and sticky notes
and they'll do just about anything for you.
Yeah. And then what advice do you give to parents?
You know, parents come to the table with their own stories. Mm-hmm. And because dyslexia is, you know, genetic, almost always one parent has their own story. And if that has been unresolved, their own shame starts to come to the surface. And it takes processing that and dealing with that, which is more often than not very traumatic, their childhood, mm-hmm. even though they're very successful right. in life. They've overcome, they've compensated, but they've never acknowledged and celebrated. And that really is what we're trying to do, is shift the paradigm. Let's celebrate it, right? And so if a parent brings that to the table, then that obviously needs to be talked about before they can truly message this to their kids as something that they shouldn't be ashamed of. And so when I first talk to parents about how they're going to explain to their child that their child has dyslexia, the messaging I give them is, A, your nonverbal communication is just as powerful as your verbal communication. B, that we want to start the conversation, and this is the conversation that was started when I first met the child with, you know, there are so many ways that we're smart. Mm. We're smart, people smart, which is generally a huge strength. We are smart in our way that we think about problems, because most often these are kids who, like I said in my, you know, opening description of the kids that I saw year after year, mm-hmm. they think outside the box. They're inquirers. They can solve complex problems. They are often amazing at visual spatial. Give them something to build. They're mm-hmm. great with their hands and seeing three-dimensionally. And so all of those smarts are things that you're going to utilize in your life. You might be sports smart, very kinesthetic. You might be art smart, right? Mm-hmm. Talented as an artist. Music, nature. And of course, there are logical and mathematical smarts, and there are word smarts. And, you know, in the word smart area, there's two ways that we can be word smart. We can be amazing with our oral language, which you are, and there's on the page, the code. And what we learned at your assessment is that the way that your brain connects those words that you know to what you see on the page is different. Because there are lots of wires in our brain, and some of them are connected in a really odd fashion. But the coolest thing about our brains is that we can rewire them. And I teach kids and I teach parents the word neuroplasticity. The idea that our brains can be rewired. And when we can rewire them, we can do things that we couldn't do before. Now, if you think about yourself, as a learner, if you've ever tried to learn something for the first time as an adult, you know it's very difficult, mm-hmm. which is why we advocate and we know early intervention is essential because the brain's ability to rewire itself is easier the younger you are. And so for this reader, this learner who is relying so heavily on the right side of their brain to do tasks that have been delegated to the left side, we can rewire it so that you can do it easier. It can be easier for you because we don't want reading and writing and spelling to be this hard for you. And I model this and I'm speaking to the parents as if I was speaking to their child so that they can then have that conversation.
I see.
And then, of course, I say, your child expects to hear from you that they're smart and that they work hard. And now they need to hear it from lots of different sources. So on my website, mm-hmm. I work so hard to create a resource section that's available to educators and parents, and it's open to anybody so that you can watch videos. There's a book list. Let your child hear that they are not alone because they feel
right.
alone.
Right.
Because this disability, dyslexia, is invisible. And because it's invisible, they look, quote unquote, normal on the outside. But inside, we know they're struggling. Mm-hmm. And we need to make them aware that there are others who are just like them.
That's a great message. Those are all really powerful messages. How can somebody get to your website?
So our website is www.pdxreadingspecialist.com. And there's, like I said, a wealth of information there, mm-hmm. and all of our other contact info is there. You could probably type in Portland Dyslexia Specialist on Google, and we're going to come up right at the top if you can't find the website.
Okay, so all the information is there if somebody, or is there a more direct route if somebody doesn't have access to the website?
Absolutely.
How would somebody get a hold of you?
So our phone number is 503-747-3491, and my amazing assistant Mandy is there to answer the call. And we always start, you know, tell us your story. Let us make sure that we're the right people for you. And if we're not the right people for you, we're going to steer you in the right direction, because it's overwhelming when you are a parent who has a child who's struggling in school and you look to the school for guidance. And like I said, as a teacher, I know teachers are well-intentioned and often they just don't know where to turn, mm-hmm. and they don't often know what they're looking at because there's so many kids and it's just too complicated to stay on top of every single facet of the educational system. And so I will, help steer you in the right direction.
Yeah, and you were saying that when you were going through college at Merrillhurst?
I went and got, my master's again at Merrillhurst.
And so that information, the information that you studied there, was research done and information that was available on the East Coast.
Exactly.
Which is now coming to universities.
Exactly. Great. There isn't a university right now west of the Rockies that offers a dyslexia program. So that needs to change. It's slowly changing. There are some online ones. So hopefully this broadcast will just be old news in a year and it will be widely available.
That would be great. And so when kids are assessed, it's done at your site in Lake Oswego. And so when is the best time to have your child assessed if a parent was interested in having an assessment to see if they have dyslexia?
Because assessment is so exhausting, we see kids in the morning.
Okay.
Their brain is freshest.
Okay.
We do a lot to prepare kids and families. Our office is a really friendly space. We have lots of interactive games and areas to take brain breaks, but we always see kids for assessment in the morning. Other appointments, any time of the day.
Okay. Well, that's nice that you're available when it's a good time to assess kids.
But the answer to your question of when I work, I think, is the answer like a teacher.
24/7. What else would you like to say?
I think that I'm so indebted to the educators that I've worked with. And I just think that our job is so difficult. And all too often when I meet a teacher and then a teacher takes a Dyslexia 101 workshop, they are so angry because they feel like I did, that we've failed so many kids. And we have to celebrate our successes, and we have to know that we are doing the absolute best that we can for every kid. And learning about dyslexia and incorporating a couple of strategies and tools into your existing tool belt will only strengthen your practice and help you reach even more kids. But as dyslexia awareness grows, don't beat yourself up for what you didn't do or could have done. And that message is true for parents too, because so many parents come in and beat themselves up. I should have come to you sooner. Mm-hmm. I should have seen the signs. And I'm such an optimist that I say, well, here we are today, right? Let's move mm-hmm. forward. Yes, dyslexia has been around since the late 1800s. The methodology we use was first, you know, written in the 1930s. Doctors
really?
Orton and Gillingham in the 1930s. We have so much dyslexia research. It's absolutely a disgrace that we are where we're at right now, but that's okay because we are here. And there are more teachers today that know about dyslexia mm-hmm. than yesterday, than last month, than last year. And a year from now, I certainly hope that I will not meet a teacher who says, so what is dyslexia?
Right.
That's my hope. And that's my mission.
All right. Well, thank you so much. You've been listening to Teacher Talk, and my guest today is PDX reading specialist owner Barbara Steinberg. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that is it for this week on Teacher Talk. Please join me on November 1st for a great interview with Charlie Blackwell, who is a second grade teacher at Chavez Elementary School here in Salem. Take care and remember to vote. Bye.